Continue our study in the Word of God. Tonight we're going to look at a book in the Bible, the book of Ecclesiastes, try to cover the chapters in that particular book and get an overall view of what is contained in this book called Ecclesiastes. In our view of how the Bible is arranged and in your English versions of the Bible that you have, you'll notice that you have grouped together these books of the Bible that we refer to as the books of poetry. That's the Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, Lamentations. And they are books of poetry. In particular, I want us to remember that when for us, we study the book of Proverbs, the book of Psalms, we look for the meaning and for the wonderful verses in there, those phrases and language that sticks out in our mind, like Psalms 23 about that shepherd, and or other passages from the book of Proverbs that kind of come to your mind. Train up a child in the way he should go, when he's old and not depart from it. He that spareth the rod spoileth the child. There's all kind of information that comes back to our mind, but I want us to try to remember how the Israelite would have viewed this. Now, the Old Testament, as we've been talking about, much of our studies in the Old Testament have been following a plan of God to bring about someone in the world, someone who would come from the family of Abraham and someone who would come from the family of David, who would make right what sin had made wrong. We'd see this great damage done in the world because of man's sin, beginning with the fall of man in the Garden of Eden, and then the process that followed, even with the flood, leading to the period of time of the flood and the events leading up to that, even after the flood, with the events that led up to the Tower of Babel, that man has always been on this continual downward spiral, it seems. That there was not a good remedy for that as it pertains to remedying what sin had done in the world and the damage sin had done. But God, long ago, had set about a plan that he would work through one man and his family, Abraham and his family, to bring about someone in the world who would indeed bless all nations and be able to conquer Satan, who is the root behind our sin and behind evil in the world, and make man have an opportunity, or give man the opportunity to be victorious over sin and overcome the damages that sin does. And so much of the Old Testament is about how God did that, how he worked through the family of Abraham, brought them out of Egypt, wandered in the promised land, gave them a land that flowed with milk and honey. And so I want us to remember that these books have significant, particularly emphasis to those people who are the descendants of Abraham, the children of Israel in the Old Testament. They mean something to us today, and they should mean something for us today. But I want us to also think about the view of how the Israelite would have viewed these books of the Bible. And these letters, these books of the Bible for them, this instruction that they received from them, was part of the process of keeping them as God's people until God could bring Jesus in the world. And we know that there's all kinds of stories and examples that we've seen so far where they worked against God a lot of the time to be able to accomplish that. That they sinned against God, they didn't keep the covenant, actually the country divided in two and split. It were left with just Judah alone for a while, and then both nations were taken into captivity, the northern with the Assyrians, the southern portion of the kingdom to the Babylonians. But God brought them back, and we studied those stories of God leading them into captivity, bringing them now back from captivity. And these books are there to help them continue their lives as God's people in the midst of all this uncertainty of life, the disappointments, the tragedies, the victories, whatever life brings to you. These had particular meaning to the people to whom that leaned on these things to continue the process of being a people, keeping us together, keeping our faith toward God, not giving up toward God, not giving up in what God has called us to be as his people, his special people. And so as we read these books of the Bible, I think it's important that you do look at them as a collection, as a group of books. That is to say that the books of poetry do belong together because of the significance they had. And one thing that we mentioned last week when we talked about the book of Proverbs is that a lot of people struggle with the book of Proverbs because they read the book of Proverbs as a book of law. That is to say that when there's a verse of Scripture in there, they nail it down as a absolute law of God that this is the way it's going to be, like the one that we alluded to earlier. Train up a child in the way he should go, when he's old and not depart from it. And if there's ever any failure, if there's people who raise a child and when he's old, he runs wild and sins against God, then they automatically assume that I failed as a parent. But I want us to remember that the Proverbs are statements that are, generally speaking, they are true statements. That God is saying that, generally speaking, if you live your life this way, if you seek wisdom, if you seek the fear, if the fear of God is in your heart, a respect for God, then you'll follow these paths in your life that will lead you to having blessed days. But there are exceptions to that. And so the way you should look, for example, at the book of Proverbs is that here's the rule. The rule is that if you'll seek wisdom, you'll fear the Lord, then you'll make decisions that are going to be good, and your life will be blessed. You will avoid evil and the consequences of evil, like alcoholism or adultery, and you won't suffer the consequences of that evil. And so things are, generally speaking, the rule is you do what's right, seek wisdom, and everything will be okay. However, there is a realism about life that that's not always the case. And there are two examples that we see in that in this Old Testament literature that deal with the exception to the rule. And one we've already studied, that is the book of Job. Job was a man who sought wisdom. He was a man who feared God. He was a man who worshiped God. He was a man who followed every instruction that you could see listed for you in the book of Proverbs. That he wasn't a man of adultery. He wasn't a man lust after other women. He wasn't a man consumed with his wealth. He wasn't a man that mistreated the poor. He didn't do any of those things. He was a man of great integrity. Yet his life in this life turned out to be a disaster. Now, the book of Ecclesiastes, again, serves as kind of a reminder that there are exceptions to the rules, that sometimes life is not going to work out for you like you think it's going to work out. And I think that's one of the great meanings here of the book of Ecclesiastes, and that's how we should see it. The book of Proverbs gave us these rules that, generally speaking, this is the way it's going to work out. But the Ecclesiastes writer reminds us that sometimes life is just hard, and it's perplexing, and it's difficult, and it's challenging, and sometimes it upsets, if we're not careful, it upsets our faith toward God. So let's talk about this great book tonight. The book of Ecclesiastes, probably my favorite book of the Old Testament, and we'll see if we can understand some meaning here. Now, I want to begin with just some words that I want to define for you. And the first one is this word right here, Koheleth. Now, in your Bible that you're using, you're probably not seeing this word. You're probably seeing the word preacher. And look at the very first verse of Ecclesiastes 1:1, and that's where we see our word. The Hebrew word is this word. And in the English version of the Bible, most of them it's translated preacher or teacher. And here's what it says, Ecclesiastes 1:1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Now this word here carries with it the idea of one who calls an assembly together. He calls together an assembly, and he does so because he's got something to say. So it's translated preacher. It's someone saying, everybody gather around. I've got something I want to say, and you need to hear it. So sometimes this is translated teacher, because I've got something to say, and you need to hear it. You need to heed it. But it's that's the idea behind this word that's translated in your Bible, preacher. The words of the preacher. Here's a man who's calling everyone forever who will read this book. He's calling out and saying, gather around. I've got something to say that you need to hear, listen to, and learn from. Now, let me give you some information about this preacher. Who is this preacher? Now, there are a lot of different views about who wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. My view is that Solomon wrote this book. And some of you might be interested to know and find out that that's kind of a minority opinion among many people in religion, that they don't view Solomon as the writer of this book. And the greatest objection usually that's given is that they can't believe Solomon would write this book and God included it in the Bible because of what Solomon did in sinning against God. You know, his heart was turned away by these women that he married and these concubines he had, and they turned his heart away from God. He even worshipped idols. The kingdom was torn from his hand at the end. And so there was a very ugly period of Solomon's reign that's not to be honored. And why would God use somebody who's an apostate if God used an apostate to write part of the Bible, this is the only book that I would know that you could say, there's a man who was an apostate before God. He turned his back on God. He turned his back on God's law. He sinned against God. This is the only book of the Bible that we can say, if Solomon wrote it, that he used that kind of person. That's not true of Paul. Paul was a man who gave his life to God and never turned back. That's not true of Peter. That's not true of Jude. That's not true of Timothy. Paul who wrote Timothy. It's not true of any other book of the Bible that we can point to and say, here's the writer of this book. But on this occasion, here's a man who was not faithful to God to the end. Now, I have a different view about that. I believe that Solomon wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. I believe he wrote it as an old man in his very aged period. I believe he does so addressing primarily, as he does in the book of Proverbs, the young people of this world, that he has something to say to the young people. And the primary message is, don't do what I've done. Don't make my mistakes and repeat some of the mistakes that I made in my view of life and how to live life. And I believe Solomon wrote this not as an apostate, but as a man who is penitent about what he had done, about the mistakes that he made. Now, that's my view. It doesn't mean it's right. I just wanted to give you an idea of why I would argue for my case here. Now, the other reason I believe that Solomon wrote this book is because the internal evidence here in these first chapters. Scriptures. Now, what do we know about the writer of this book? Well, one thing we know about him is that he was a king. We know that he was a king in Jerusalem. And that narrows it down, doesn't it? That he was king in Jerusalem because some of the kings didn't reign in Jerusalem. And we also know here that he was the son of David. And that kind of narrows it down. Not all kings were the son of David. So he was a king. He was a king in Jerusalem. He was the son of David. But the other thing that we learned about this king, look at what it says here in chapter 1 and verse 12. Chapter 1, verse 12. I, the preacher, was king over Israel. So he knows that he was king over Israel. What does that mean? What does that tell you about the period of time in which he was king? That he was a king during the United Kingdom. All right? And there were only three kings that reigned as king during the period of time of the United Kingdom. That was Saul, David, and Solomon. The rest of them couldn't be able to say, I was king over all of Israel, because Israel divided after the reign of Solomon. And furthermore, we learn about this king here. It says in verse 13, that I set my heart to seek and search out wisdom concerning all that is done in the heaven and the burdensome task God has given to the man. I have seen all the works that are done, indeed all is vanity. So I said, I learned and sought for wisdom. And then he goes on to say, I gained much wisdom. I was wiser, he said, than all that were before me in Jerusalem. So all this evidence linked together tends to lead me to believe that indeed Solomon is the preacher. And he's saying here, I've got something to say. The world needs to hear the message that I have, and I'll call everybody together to listen to me and to think about what it is that I want to say and how it is that I want to address the world. Now, let me give you some other phrases here that you'll see come up. Here's another key phrase of the book of Ecclesiastes, and this is, you'll see this several times, under the sun. Under the sun. What is he talking about when he uses this phrase? You see an example of here at the very beginning of the writing. He says in verse 3 of chapter 1, what profit has a man from all of his labor in which he toils under the sun? Well, the phrase under the sun just means simply life on earth. That's where you are under the sun. You're under the sun if you're living life here on earth. I suppose, Keith, you could say you'd be under the sun if you were living life on Mars too, wouldn't you? But we're not living life on Mars. We're living life on earth. So under the sun means we're living here on this world. So what he's talking about, life here on earth. For those who are living in this world here, what is this book is about? Now here's another word, a phrase that comes up over again. And the word is vanity. That word or a form of that word is used, I think, about 40 times, depending on what translation you're using, 38 to 40 times throughout the chapters of this book. Vanity of vanity. Again, we see that at the very beginning. Look at what he says in verse 2. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. And so over and over again, he comes back to this theme. He talks about all the things that he sought, things he worked for, things he did. And at the end, he would say, vanity of vanities. Now, depending on your translation may use the word meaningless. That all is meaningless. But the word vanity, the word that's translated vanity in our English Bibles, is kind of carries with it a bigger idea than just the idea of something being vain or meaningless or empty. In the original language, in the Hebrew language, the word is hevel, H-E-V-E-L, and it's the idea of vapor or smoke. And I think the point of the language here is when he says all is vapor and smoke, it looks real. You know, the idea is that what you're chasing in life, he goes on to describe as being things that are vanity, that's meaningless, that's empty, that's hevel or hevel. It's like the idea of chasing after vapor or smoke. Now, smoke and vapor, they're real. They can be seen. All right, but you can't ever get a hold of it. You can't really ever grasp it and take hold of it. And that's the point that he comes back to over and over again about the things that he tries in life here under the sun. That he looks at something and he says, that's what it is. It's wealth. That's what I see. I see people that's got money. That's going to do it for me. So he chases it. He gets a lot of wealth, but he doesn't really grab onto what he thought he was going to be grabbing onto. Or it's going to be pleasure. That's where it's at. I want to get pleasure, so I got to grasp hold of pleasure. So he runs to grasp hold of all of his pleasures, but he can never catch it. It's like you trying to catch smoke in your hands or vapor in your hands. It's the idea of something being kind of a paradox or something having an enigma about it. If you work hard all your life to get all these things because you thought that's what you're supposed to be doing, and then you get to the end of your life and you leave all these things to somebody else. It's like, this didn't do it. This didn't accomplish what I thought I was going to accomplish. So when he uses this word, what he's saying is, I'm chasing smoke, man. I'm chasing vapors. I see it. It looks real, but I really can't ever get a hold of it to make it mean something to me. There's nothing solid there behind the things that I've been chasing in my life. In fact, he describes it in one of the verses here of chasing after the wind. You pursue it, but you can never really get a hold of it and bring it to your life and make it make sense to you. Now, there are a lot of people who approach the book of Ecclesiastes, and they have different thoughts about really the attitude about the preacher here and what his attitude is. Some people say, well, this book is a book of fatalism. That is to say, this guy is pessimistic, and him everything just kind of ends in destruction and never amounts to nothing. An example of what we're talking about, Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Look at what the Ecclesiastes writer says here. Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Consider the work of God, for who can make straight what he's made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful, but in the day of adversity, consider. So he says here, God has set things in order, and you can't do nothing about it. You're stuck here. You're like a rat in a wheel, man. God has put all this in motion, and there's a time for you, a moment for you, a spot for you. You can't change it if you wanted to. What God has made straight, for who can make straight what God has made crooked? And if your path is a crooked path, and that's just going to be the path you own, ain't nothing you do about it. And so there's just this resignation of that this is the way it is, my days are sealed, and I can't do anything about it. And then some people see that, well, what we're just talking about here is not necessarily that bad. But there is a tremendous amount of pessimism in this book. Hope I didn't get too many S's in there, Miss Brooks. Tremendous amount of pessimism in this book. And there's an example of that. Look at what it says in chapter 4 and verse 2. He says in verse 1, I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. So he's saying here, I'm looking at all the bad things that happened here on earth. And look, the tears of the oppressed, they have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors, there's power, they have no comfort, but they have no comforter. Therefore, I praise the dead who were already dead more than the living who were still alive. Now, that seems pretty pessimistic. That it's better for those who are already dead than those who are still alive. And then there are those here who say, well, this book is filled with defeatism. You can try and you work and you make the effort, but there's going to be something always holding you back. Look at chapter 3. Chapter 3, verse 19. For what happens to the sons of man also happens to the animal. One thing befalls them. As one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have one breath. The man has no advantage over the animals, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and all return to the dust. And who knows the spirit of the sons of men, which goes upward, and the spirit of the animal, which goes downward to the earth. So he says here at this point that, and really there's so many ways, man ain't no better than an animal. I mean, they both live, and they both die. And when they die, what happens to them? They both return to the dust from which you came. And by the way, here's a good question for you. For those of you who are at home, this is great. Keith, you think about this and get back to me. Do animals have a spirit? Do animals have a spirit? Now, some of y'all already texting me. They're probably already texting Birch back there. Well, look at what it says here. Verse 21. Who knows the spirit of the sons of men, which goes upward, and the spirit of the animal, which goes down to the earth? So think about it. Get back to me on that. But here's his bigger point. There ain't much difference between us and animals. If both have a spirit, then that spirit goes to wherever it belongs. But the flesh, they all go to the same place. They all go to the dust. And the spirit of man goes up to God, and the spirit of the beast goes back to the earth, to the earth from which it came. But I think that the better way of looking at it, that the proper way of examining what this man's talking about through this book, is not fatalism, it's not pessimism, it's not defeatism, it's this. It's realism. that this is what life is for everybody. This is what it is. And in this book, he challenges us. He kind of what he does is deconstructs these notions that men have in their mind. That this is how I'm going to make life have meaning. And I'm going to make life have meaning by my wealth. I'm going to make life have meaning by my knowledge. You know, one of the things you hear people preach all the time is education, education, education. Education, education. Is education important? It is. It's important. My grandfather used to say that education is great until it makes a fool out of a man. Well, it does that for some people too, doesn't it? But look at what he says, for example, here in Ecclesiastes chapter 1 about knowledge. And he says in verse 16, I commune with my heart saying, look, I've attained greatness. I've gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And I perceive that this also is a grasping for the wind. For in much wisdom is much grief. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Now, do you believe that? Do you believe he who increases knowledge increases sorrow? Now, Birch, I bet you the happiest you ever been in your life was when you was a little boy and didn't know nothing. That you didn't watch the news, you didn't care about it, nothing bothered you, didn't worry about anything, and you didn't know what 2 + 2 was, but you didn't care, did you? But as you've gotten older, as we've all gotten older, and we've learned more about life and what makes life work and the responsibilities of life, and we've taken on more responsibilities of life, you know so much more now than you used to know, and some of it makes you sad, doesn't it? Some of your knowledge doesn't make you happy. Some of your knowledge, so with increased knowledge increases sorrow. And some of the sorrow comes because you realize as much as you've come to know, that there's so much more to know that you'll never know. And so people pursue that, but they don't find it. And so they just give up sometimes and say, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll quit worrying about money and knowledge and I'll just have a good time. I'll drink, be merry, get out here and have myself a good time and see what that does for me. He talked about that in chapter 2. And he talks about possessions and status, all of that, trying to find this meaning and purpose in life. And he says every time that he pursued those things, that it was nothing. It didn't bring him anything. Look at what he says in verse 9 of chapter 2. He said, I became great, and I excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem, and I had my wisdom with me too. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. This was my reward for my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, on the labor which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and the grasping for wind. For there is no profit under the sun. So the realistic thing in life, as you learn, is in those pursuits of life, and the things that man thinks will make him happy. He walks you through his effort to find meaning and happiness and longevity of contentment in those things. And he says, that's smoke that I never grasped. That's a vapor I never could take hold of. And the realistic thing is that there's so much about life that is depressing, that is pessimistic, that does seem that we're just kind of on a defeatist path here and not going to be able to accomplish what it is that our mission is and purpose is in life. Now, throughout this book, let me give you a couple other thoughts here. We'll bring all this together. There are two great enemies of man, he says here. He kind of goes through these themes. Here are the two great enemies that man has. Time and death. Now, how is it that time is our enemy? Well, time is our enemy because you and I have a limited amount of time. We had a limited amount of time. That's how it's an enemy for us. And the truth is that for most people, listen to this, this is true. For most people, time erases any evidence that you were here. It erases any evidence of your life that you were even here. Now, we remember some people who were here, but we wouldn't remember them if there weren't books written about them, if there weren't monuments made to them, if there weren't statues somewhere. We wouldn't know they were ever before us. You know, I know who George Washington was. He was the first president of the United States. Okay? I can't tell you how many people were living in the world at that time in the 1700s, between the time he was born and died. I don't know how many people lived on this earth. But during that period of time, I can't name you but a handful of people who lived during that period of time. Now, I can name you Benjamin Franklin. I can name you John Hancock. I can name you Thomas Jefferson. I can name you a few of those people that we remember because they're associated with this great thing that happened. But for the most part, the millions of people who lived around the world during that period of time, I can't tell you who they was. Don't have any, and the world didn't have any memory of them. Is that time is the great enemy. And that's what he says here in chapter 1. He starts out the book that way. Verse 3, what profit has a man for everything he does here under the sun? And he goes on to talk about what does time do? It erases all. One generation passes away. Another generation comes. But the earth abides forever. The sun rises, the sun goes down, hastens to the place where it rose. The wind goes toward the south, returns to the north. The wind swirls about continually, comes again on the circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. And let me tell you what he's saying. That's going to go on long after you're gone from here. Hundreds of years after you're gone from here, the rivers are still going to run into the ocean, and they still ain't going to be full, and ain't nobody even going to know that you were here. So why are you here, if that's the case? What profit does a man have for spending his time on this earth under the sun? Well, there's an interesting phrase that he comes back. And death is the great enemy of man because in death, death in many ways is the great equalizer. It makes everybody the same. Whether you wise or a fool, whether you rich or poor, death is the great equalizer. It comes to all. Look at what he says here in Ecclesiastes chapter 8. Ecclesiastes chapter 8, beginning of verse 10, where he speaks about death and its effect on humanity. He says, verse 10, I saw the wicked buried, who had come and gone from the place of holiness, and there were they were forgotten. In the city which they had done so done, this is vanity. Because the sentence against an evil worker is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and his days are prolonged, yet I surely know that it'll be well with those who fear God, who fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked, nor will he prolong his days which are as a shadow, because he does not fear before God. There is a vanity which occurs on the earth. Now he's saying here, here's what I believe. I do believe there's a consequence for being evil, that you will have to answer to God one day. He says, but there is something about that, verse 14, there is a vanity which occurs, that there are just men to whom it happens according to the work of the wicked. That there are some people who are good people, but life's hard on them. And their life is bad, even though they're good people. He says here again, there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. Now he said, now this is vanity. I don't understand this. This doesn't seem right. But it's real. It's what happens. It's just the way life is. So I commended enjoyment because a man has nothing better under the sun than to eat, drink, be merry, and for this will remain with him in his labor all the days of his life, which God gives him under the sun. And when I apply my heart to know wisdom and see the business that is done on the earth, even though one sees no sleep day or night, then I saw all the work of God that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. For though a man labors to discover it, yet he will not find it. Moreover, though a wise man attempts to know it, he will not be able to find it. And then he goes on to say here in the next chapter, verse 2, one event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good, the clean, and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As the good, so is the sinner. He who takes an oath is though who fears an oath. Now, the very first line of verse 2 says, all things come alike to all. And there are many things that come alike to all, whether you're good or bad. And that's one of the things that he struggled with. Why, if that's true, why, what is the purpose about doing good and being good? If there are exceptions to the rule, then why are we encouraged by wisdom to do good and to do righteousness? Now, let me tell you what I really think he's getting at too here in this book here. And you'll see this over and over. There's a phrase that pops up several times. And the phrase is the gift of God. There are two attitudes or two dispositions that we ought to view life with. And that is, enjoy the simple things. That's how you should view life. Just find joy in the simple things. And the main purpose is to prepare for life to come. To prepare for life to come. Now, while you're doing this, while you're waiting for eternity, you're going to be living down here under the sun where there's going to be a lot of times you think, this makes no sense whatsoever. I can't find no meaning here. This is emptiness. So what should be your attitude when you see life and you see the same things happen to the good and the bad, the rich and the poor, the wise and the foolish? Then what's your view about that? How do you deal with that? Well, one thing the writer says over and over again, just take a moment to be thankful that when you in life, through this miserable life, through this life that is sometimes painful and hard and challenging, because we've messed it up with sin, when you something good happens, you better stop and enjoy it. Not sinful. Stop and enjoy it and be thankful. Be thankful. Look for the small things. Look at what he says in chapter 2, verse 24. Nothing is better for a man than he should eat and drink and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. It is the gift of God. What's the gift of God here? That you work hard and you have something to show for it that blesses your life, that you eat and drink and you're able to take care of yourself. Now find blessing in that. Be thankful for that. Look at that as a gift for God. For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight, but to the sinner gives the work of gathering and collecting, that he may give to him who is good before God. This also is vanity and the grasping for wind. Look in chapter 3, verse 12. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. Now think about what he's saying over and over again. There is purpose behind your time here. And all the mundane things that you do every day, going to the tire store, going to the office, going to the fields, whatever it is that you're doing, if you want to keep from having such a negative outlook on life, you stop and smell the roses and be thankful for the simple things that you have every day. That when you sit down at night with you and your wife and your family, your boys, your girls, and you eat supper, find meaning and purpose in that. Find a blessing. That's a gift of God to you. God wants us to enjoy our time here on earth as much as possible without involving in sin and wickedness. Look at what he says in chapter 5. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 18. Here's what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toiled under the sun all the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage. And he talks about here, God gives you this. What does God give you to do? Well, God gives you an opportunity to work, and therefore, because of that, to enjoy your daily life, to eat and to drink and enjoy the good of all of his labor which he toils here under the sun. Chapter 7, verse 14. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. In the day of adversity, consider. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that man can find out nothing that will come after him. Now, here's the point of that. You should look at every event of life as an opportunity from God to learn. So if you have prosperity, then you be thankful. You be joyful to God. If you have a day of adversity, then you stop and consider. God gave you both. So allow both of those to have meaning to you and to bless your life. Chapter 8, verse 15. Look at what he says. Now there was found in it a poor... Well, that's not where I want to be. Chapter 9. Chapter 8, verse 15 says, so I commended enjoyment because a man has nothing better under the sun than to eat, drink, and be merry. For this will remain with him in all of his labor, all the days of his life which God gives him under the sun. There's blessings to be found in everyday life. If you stop and consider the greatest view of life that God wants you to have. Now this book begins with the question saying, "Why? What am I here for? What profit is there for man for all he has to do under the sun? What profit is? Well, number one, there's enjoyment to be had from the simple things in life. Being blessed with family and a job and working and hard, enjoying what comes from that. But there's a bigger prize. What is man? Why is man here? What is your purpose? What is it that really is something solid that you can grab onto? Now, all these other things, we're grasping for wind. We're grasping for the vapor. We're trying to catch smoke. But there is something that we can gain that is real and not fleeting. And not meaningless or empty. And it's the purpose for which we're put here, the true purpose for our lives here. Now think about where Solomon's at. Think about where the writer's at, the preacher, whoever you think this to be. And I think that's what he's doing here is he's preaching to the young people primarily, and he's saying, don't make the mistakes I made early in my life, young in my life. For I missed the call and purpose. My view of life was so misguided because I thought this is what life was about. And I've proved to you and showed you through this sermon, as I've spoken here and wrote to you, I've showed you that's not what life is about. That doesn't bring meaning to life. So what is life about? So he says here in chapter 12 and verse 13, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is man's all. And tells you why in the next verse. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. There is one day after these days here under the sun. There is one day, a day of reckoning before God, where God will measure our lives here. God will measure our lives by respect for him and his commandments. And if you think about it from the standpoint of the Israelite who's been journeying, the Israelite who's been in captivity, the Israelite who's returned from captivity to a disappointed nation, the Israelite who's had bad leaders and bad kings or good kings, and he's gone through the swings of this, that he's reading this, and God is reminding him that whatever situation you find in, find the small things to take pleasure in and have joy in this life. But remember the big picture, that you're my people. I have a purpose for you. And one day you will stand before me and be judged. That is the big picture of us all. That's why you're here. That's your purpose, to fear God and to keep his commandments. That is your all. And that's what the book of Ecclesiastes is about and what it's trying to convey to those who read it then, who read it now, and who will read it forever. Our time is gone for our study tonight, and Lord willing, we'll be here at the building Sunday for our online service. And next Wednesday night, I have a surprise speaker for you. I won't be here, but somebody will. You have to tune in and see who it is. All right, we'll see you next time. Thank you.